At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, nothing else seems to have worked, so can the fat cats be shamed into submission? If the big bankers won't start curbing their lucrative payouts, international regulators think they should at least reveal what they're making and explain why they deserve those millions. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for making us a part of your Tuesday, this December 28th. International regulators have drawn up a plan of attack on bank bonuses. They're aiming to shine a sort of spotlight of shame on executives who keep paying themselves like the economic disaster never happened. If the draft proposal is adopted, banks in the U.S., Europe, and elsewhere would have to disclose how much they're paying top staff and why. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
There's nothing new about banks revealing how much they're paying out in bonuses, but this plan from the International Basel Committee of Regulators goes somewhat further, banking analyst Ralph Silver.
What's unique about this particular regulation is that they're not required just to announce how much money they're paying. They have to announce how much money they're paying to whom, and that's sort of a stretch that we've never seen before from a regulatory point of view.
Under the plan, banks would have to spell out why individual bankers deserve their bonus. The idea? That markets will then police the payouts. Investors will dump the shares of banks perceived as doling out too much and encouraging staff to take too many risks. Peter Hahn is a former investment banker who advises Britain's financial regulator. He thinks this much disclosure could backfire.
I'm not sure if it doesn't have a reverse effect where somebody says, wait a second, those guys pay more. Why shouldn't I move to that bank?
Too much transparency, he says, might actually lead to banks vying with each other to pay even bigger bonuses. Analyst Ralph Silver says he certainly doesn't believe the Basel plan will lead to lower pay for bankers.
Unfortunately, the problem with the banking industry is that there's simply not enough people in the world with the skill sets required to do banking. The problem is a long-term problem. We need to educate more people with these skills.
Creating more bankers may not be to everyone's taste, and anyway will take time. The Basel plan, if adopted, could be implemented within months. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Brace yourself for a double dip in housing prices. That word today from Standard & Poor's. Its Case-Shiller Index shows home prices took a dive in all 20 of the housing markets surveyed during October. Before the holidays, Congress voted to keep spending levels where they are right now to keep the government's lights on till March 4th. Which brings us to those new financial reforms that two key agencies are supposed to start carrying out. They aren't getting the money to do that from the Congress that passed that law in the first place. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Last year, the Securities and Exchange Commission asked Congress to increase its billion-dollar budget to beef up oversight of the financial system.
Congress, unfortunately, has left the SEC in a little bit of a bind.
Attorney Rick Firestone spent 12 years at the SEC. He says the top securities regulator needed the money so it could write new rules and hire new staff under the Dodd-Frank Act.
At a minimum, it certainly seems as if there's going to be some delay in how this is implemented.
Earlier this month, the SEC said it can't afford to start offices that would oversee municipal securities and corporate whistleblowers. James Cox teaches at Duke. He says he can't fathom waiting any longer for an SEC office of credit ratings.
to think that we're not going to be staffing that at the level that we ought to be staffing seems to me to be cutting off our nose to spite our face.
After all, he says, the credit rating agencies contributed to the financial meltdown. Passing Dodd-Frank was a bear. Implementing it will be even harder. Fred Rivera is a lawyer with Perkins Coie.
I think it's probably the first announcement of delays related to Dodd-Frank that we're going to see over the coming months.
He and James Cox say that you can't underestimate the power of the purse. Next year, Congress could continue to starve the SEC and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which also asked the government for more money. SEC spokesman John Nestor says the whole agency is strained. They can't pay expert witnesses, attorneys can't travel to depositions, and they're relying on outdated technology. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
2010 was a great trading year for Facebook, Twitter, and Groupon. Yes, I said trading, even though their stock doesn't trade yet on a public exchange. Their share value was soared on a secondary market. But it seems that trading may be getting too popular for its own good. Word is the SEC is taking a closer look. Here's Marketplace's Janet Babin.
The value of Twitter is up to $3.7 billion, Facebook more than $40 billion. New York securities attorney Mitchell Littman says these skyrocketing values are based on what investors are willing to pay on the private secondary market.
The valuations are obviously difficult to ascertain other than pure market forces. I mean, this is kind of classic supply and demand type of situation.
Supply of private shares comes from employees who have the company okay to sell or early investors who want to cash out. The demand for the shares comes from what the Securities and Exchange Commission calls accredited investors.
You have to have $1 million of net worth.
That's SharesPost CEO Dave Weir. His company matches buyers with antsy insiders who don't want to wait for a company to go public. The big payday, after all, comes when a company makes its initial public offering.
The time to achieve an exit through an IPO has expanded from about 4.5 years to about 10.5 years today.
But these investments can be risky. There's no guarantee what the shares will fetch if a company does go public. That may be one reason the SEC is reportedly investigating private trading. Securities attorney Lance Kimmel says these privately held firms may be getting too many shareholders.
If a company has more than 500 shareholders, that company has to become a fully reporting company.
Meaning the firm would have to release detailed financial information. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Another mixed day for stocks, but bond prices were decidedly down. Details when we do the numbers. You know that old saying, getting there is half the fun? Well, maybe not when getting there involves being stranded at the airport. Around 7,000 flights have been canceled since the big weekend storm hit the eastern U.S., but that number doesn't tell the whole story. Matthew Bishop's journey from London to JFK took around 11 hours, most of that staring at the snowy runway. He's New York bureau chief for The Economist magazine and is on the line with us now. Matthew Bishop, welcome.
Hi, good to be with you.
Yeah, it is good to have you here. Walk us through what happened once you landed in New York last night.
Well, we got into New York on a British Airways flight at about 10:20 in the evening, and the pilot came on and said, well, we're going to have to taxi quite slowly because the conditions are still so bad. And then he came on about an hour later and said, it's going to be a bit of a while before we get to the gate. There are 6 planes in front of us in a queue. And then a bit later, he said, we're not going to make it for a while longer. And eventually, it went until 6 a.m. before they managed to get to the gate. So we were, 7.5 hours just sitting on the runway.
Did the crew have any explanation as to why it took so long?
They were just saying, adverse conditions. And, then they started to speculate that the immigration and customs staff had all gone home and therefore they couldn't let a plane that had come from abroad get to the gates, because that would mean that there'd be a lot of passengers that were there and nobody to process them.
Yeah, I heard there was an Aeromexico flight that came into JFK from Mexico City a couple hours behind schedule, and then passengers waited 6 hours to get off that flight. And one passenger reported that even when the plane did pull up at the gate, that the doors didn't open until 7 a.m. So that would suggest that maybe it was a backup with the customs agents. He'd heard that they just went home at 1 a.m.
Yeah, so we were, once we got to the gate, it was 35 minutes waiting for the customs people to allow us off the plane. You know, which is pretty frustrating once you've actually finally made it to the gate.
I have to ask you, how did the passengers handle this ordeal?
Yeah, surprisingly well. I suppose the fact it was the middle of the night meant that a lot of people just kind of went to sleep, actually. And a lot of people were obviously very relieved to even have made it to American soil, even if we hadn't been able to actually get out of the plane.
Now, you were tweeting while you were on the plane. Did having that outlet help you out a little bit?
Well, it does sort of get the frustration out of your system a bit when you can just sort of shout out to the world that you're stuck on this runway and no one seems to know about it. I'm not sure it had any effect on anyone in power to actually do anything to get us out of the plane quicker.
Based on your experience, just in terms of the business aspect of this for the airlines, any thoughts on what they could do differently to avoid this kind of situation, or at least make it easier to get through for the passengers, for their customers?
I mean, I think one of the things that's happened in the last few years has been that the airlines have pushed a lot more of the cost back onto the passengers. So, you know, rather than have excess capacity and a bit of slack in the system, they've actually just cut everything to the bone so that the passengers bear the pain when things go wrong. And I do feel that it's profit sometimes at the expense of the customer. And in the end, more and more people, I think, are going to question whether they really want to make some of the journeys that they make.
We understand you have to leave to catch a flight to Miami this afternoon. Good luck with that.
Yeah, well, allegedly it's still going to fly, but I probably won't find out that it's canceled until I get to the airport in that kind of year.
Well, I hope you don't have to spend too much more time in airports. Matthew Bishop, New York bureau chief for The Economist magazine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Time for the folks who explore the hidden side of everything, even when it might be repugnant. Every couple of weeks, we bring you Freakonomics Radio, and we've got Stephen Dubner, co-author of the books and blog of the same name. Now, most of us like to stick to ideas that are politically and socially palatable, but some people are attracted to repugnant ideas, ideas to solve tough problems, even if they might be greeted with disgust. Our Freakonomics team are connoisseurs of these kinds of repugnant ideas, and they've been tracking a few that took root in 2010. So here's Dubner.
My co-author Steve Levitt is a research economist at the University of Chicago. His most famous piece of work? A paper arguing that the massive drop in crime that began in the early 1990s was due in large part to legalized abortion. The paper took no position on abortion per se. It only examined the cause and effect. Still, a lot of people, whatever their religious or moral feelings about abortion, found the idea entirely repugnant.
One of the easiest ways to differentiate an economist from almost anyone else in society is to test them with repugnant ideas. Because economists, either by birth or by training, have their mind open or skewed in just such a way that instead of thinking about whether something is right or wrong, they think about whether it's sufficient, whether it makes sense. And many of the things that are most repugnant are the things which are indeed quite efficient, but for other reasons, subtle reasons sometimes, reasons that are hard for people to understand, are completely and utterly unacceptable.
Here's an inefficiency that drives some economists crazy: organ donation. Every year, thousands of people in the U.S. die while waiting for a new kidney. Meanwhile, millions of people are walking around with a second spare kidney that they could donate, but the incentives to do so aren't strong. Some economists have proposed a market paying people for their organs. Pretty repugnant, right? Professor Jacob Levy is a transplant surgeon near Tel Aviv. He was frustrated by Israel's low organ donor rate, so this year he helped champion a new law.
I'm fully aware of the fact that it's a very drastic law. It's a very drastic law, and it had to be drastic because the situation is drastic.
The new law is called Give Life, Get Life. It means that if you sign up to be an organ donor, then you get preference if you ever need an organ yourself. So instead of being prioritized solely by medical need, which is the custom around the world, you'll be punished for not participating. Desperate times call for repugnant measures. Sometimes the level of repugnance may mess with your morals, and sometimes just grosses you out.
It's a psychological stigma about the water.
That's Brad Hahn, a councilman in Modesto, a city of 200,000 in California's fertile Central Valley. Hawn is trying to get Modesto to do what other places around the world have done. Treat its sewage wastewater and pipe it off to farmers who need it. In this case, for their almonds and apricots. It's a program you might call crap to crop.
Really what's happened in California is that the need for water has gotten so great that the stigma is starting to go away because, you know, when you're thirsty, you start being a little less particular about what the water is, where it comes from.
Another repugnant idea from the past year comes out of the healthcare debate. Remember the proposal to reimburse doctors for counseling patients about end-of-life care? This idea, which came to be known as death panels, was repugnant to a lot of people, even Steve Levitt. But what he really finds repugnant is that the end-of-life debate doesn't follow the rules of the marketplace. If it did, says Levitt,
there won't be any need for death panels because actually your children will be your own personal death panel, right? Because you're 85 years old, you're on life support. If your children are paying a substantial part of the bill, then they'll face an awkward trade-off. They'll face a trade-off. Would I rather have money to send the grandchildren to college, or would I rather keep my mother who's in a coma and is 85 years old, would I rather keep her alive for another 2 weeks?
Ah, economists. Children as death panel. Now there's something to look forward to in 2011. I'm Stephen Dubner for Marketplace.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud.
Coming up, Oprah shifts focus from daytime TV to cable network.
One of the ways to measure how successful she's been in this transition is just, does she stay part of the cultural dialogue?
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks didn't do much of anything today. The Dow Industrials gained 20 points, 0.1% to end at 11,575. The NASDAQ peeled off 4 points, or 0.1% to finish at 2662. The S&P 500 rose less than a point, closing virtually flat at 1258. The blizzard in the east pushed energy prices up. Chevron bubbled up more than 1%. Chesapeake Energy followed suit by 1%. And Adarco Petroleum oozed up 0.5%. U.S. Treasuries fell broadly today. The possibility of a stronger U.S. economy this coming year seems to be luring some investors into stocks instead. As the 10-year T-note fell, the yield climbed to 3.48%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Preparations in Pasadena continue for the annual Tournament of Roses Parade on New Year's Day. Can't wait? Some of the parade bands perform field shows for the next 2 days. Any traffic where you are? My commute is sweet. I think everyone but me is on vacation. President Obama is still taking some downtime in Hawaii. And singer and actress Marianne Faithfull turned 64. Happy birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Rizdal. How's this for a sad sign of the times? Starting with the new year, the government will be changing the way it records long-term unemployment. It will track the length someone has gone without work, not just for the 2 years it does now, but out as far as 5 years. Our own Mitchell Hartman has been tracking the ups and downs of unemployment all year, and he's here now to review our progress. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Bob.
So, we end 2010 with some sobering stats. Unemployment at 9.8%, only 39,000 jobs added last month. Government's actually slashing payrolls. Private employers are barely picking up the slack. That sounds a lot like we're running in place. Are we making progress or not?
Well, you know, I can run down for you a long list of worsts and near worsts still at this point, you know, what, 18 months into the recovery. Long-term unemployment, competition for the jobs that are available, the number of discouraged workers. Then again, you know, when you look at where we were 1 year ago, although it may not feel like it, things are actually a lot better.
Well, we know a lot of Americans don't feel that way because in November, voters threw out a lot of the folks who presided over the so-called recovery so far.
Right. But the labor market really is in much better shape. I mean, economically, at least, though obviously not if you've already been employed for a while or maybe you sit across the breakfast table from someone who has. Mm-hmm. But let me paint this picture. In December of last year, we lost 100,000 private sector jobs. Sometimes last year, we were losing 700,000-800,000 a month. That is just staggering.
Yeah.
Fast forward to this year, every single month, private employers have added workers. It's not a huge wave, but it's not a little trickle either. It averages more than 100,000 a month, and that's really not so bad.
Not so bad, but is it enough jobs to whittle away at unemployment?
Well, no, it really isn't. And this is what keeps economists awake at night. The problem is the layoffs in the recession were just so massive, we're not catching up at all now. We're barely adding enough jobs for young people entering the workforce, in fact. Gary Bertless is a labor economist at the Brookings Institution, and he says basically this has never happened after a recession going all the way back to World War II.
The truly extraordinary thing about the recession and recovery so far has been employers are not creating job openings at the pace we expect. Looking at the experience of the last year, it would probably take 25 years for the unemployment rate to get down to 5%, which is what full employment looks like.
Okay, so seems to me this is the question. So what at this point would get employers to hire more?
Well, we're about to get more than $800 billion in federal stimulus. That comes from the tax cuts and extending jobless benefits. That could add a few million jobs. That's not nothing. Liberals have been pushing for a much more aggressive attack on unemployment, a new public works program like in the Depression, a payroll tax holiday for employers that would make it cheaper to hire people. But with deficit hawks roosting in the high places, as it were, I wouldn't hold your breath. Fundamentally, the economy just needs to get stronger. Consumer and business spending still weak, so employers are incredibly cautious.
But the economy is expected to grow faster now. We've been hearing that in recent days. So in a year, will we say the unemployment crisis of the Great Recession is finally behind us?
Probably not. I'm guessing when we do this next year, we'll still have unemployment around 9%. It's going to be awful for people who've already been unemployed a long time. But, you know, for the rest of us who still go to work every day, Gary Bertless says things actually are looking up.
Their work week is rising, their hourly pay is improving in inflation-adjusted dollars, and their chances of getting laid off have declined.
So what we've got is recession-scarred survivors doing better in this leaner, meaner economy, and then the walking wounded, these people still looking desperately for work even as the economy continues to recover.
Makes me feel a little thankful, Mitchell.
Me too.
Mitchell Hartman, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
We've got more of 2010's top business stories in our Year in Review series, as well as our most popular slideshows, videos, and other features. It's all at marketplace.org. Oprah Winfrey has had an hour on television 5 days a week for 25 years. It's reportedly worth $150 million a year, but in the coming year, the show will end. This Saturday, Oprah launches OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network, on cable. But here's the thing. Even if she succeeds beyond everyone's expectations, Oprah will probably never have as many viewers as she does now. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
On January 1st, Oprah goes from a one-hour talk show to a 24-hour network.
What if I could take every story that ever moved me and give it to you?
Oprah herself is committed to only 70 hours on air a year. She'll star in a reality series behind the scenes of her current show and host hour-long biographies of her favorite people. There'll also be shows for her regulars, like Peter Walsh, the guy who helps you organize your home, a series for Oprah's best friend, Gail King, even a spin-off from one of her interviews, Duchess of York Sarah Ferguson.
It's great. It's exciting to be part of OWN.
Cable analysts predict OWN will get, at best, 1 million people to tune in during primetime. That's a sixth of the audience for Oprah's talk show.
That's, to some extent, the breaks of the game in cable or pay TV network television.
James Dix follows the cable industry for Wedbush Securities. Cable networks bring in other revenue, fees that they charge providers like Time Warner and DirecTV for every subscriber that has access to a channel each month.
In cable, those affiliate fees are a very important part of measuring the success of a network.
The Oprah Winfrey Network is taking over an existing channel, Discovery Health. Right now, that brings in around 7 cents a subscriber. Dick says Winfrey's network is looking to bump that to 20 or 30 cents. He says Spike TV was one of the last successful networks to launch. That was in 2003. Spike rebranded an existing network, too, and targeted a younger, mainly male audience with content like this.
Who's hotter, Eva Mendes or Eva Longoria?
Mendes. She's totally smoking.
Really?
Mendes. Longoria.
Spike's been able to drive its affiliate fees to around 22 cents a subscriber. But some say there's a danger Oprah's new venture could go the way of another broadcasting legend, Howard Stern. 5 years ago, Stern moved from commercial radio to Sirius satellite radio. Joseph Priester, a marketing professor at the University of Southern California, says Stern had trouble luring people to pay the subscriptions to listen to him.
6 months into Sirius, you couldn't find him in a newspaper. For Oprah, one of the ways to measure how successful she's been in this transition is just, does she stay part of the cultural dialogue?
Priester thinks Oprah's fans will pay to keep up with her wherever she goes. Just look, he says, at the 3 million people who pay to subscribe to her magazine.
I think when you have a brand like Oprah, expectations are going to be great.
Nelson Gayton teaches media management at the University of California, Los Angeles.
But nonetheless, there are expectations that need to be managed, because one thing is running a great TV show, and the other thing is running a network.
The network's co-producers at Discovery have already tempered expectations, saying it may take time for OWN to find its voice. Gayton says Oprah will have to be aggressive to find shows that work.
It's her name on this darn network, and that does wonders to motivate people.
And if that doesn't work, there are always 5,000 hours of reruns from her daytime talk show. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note, there's word from Cornell University that economist Alfred Kahn has died of cancer. He was known as the father of airline deregulation after he successfully argued for free competition between air carriers during Jimmy Carter's administration. Serving later as Carter's inflation czar, his outspokenness brought a White House rebuke when he started warning of a looming depression. Kahn agreed to come up with a substitute for the D word and preached instead that the nation was at risk of the worst banana you've ever seen. Later, he changed it to a kumquat. Alfred Kahn was 93. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 20 points, or 0.1%. The Nasdaq peeled off 4 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 gained less than a point, closing virtually flat. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Padakis of our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Next time, running a global business without fancy investments or even a loan.
I grew up in the Depression. We lost the home, we lost the farm, the cattle died in the field, but I'll never forget that. I still live in that period of time.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.